So just kind of a note as we begin on how we should do that. The first thing we're going to talk about is the good friends, characteristics of good friends, or things that we should find in a good friend, or how good friends behave. The first one on that is going to be the love of a friend. And as the proverb says there in 17:17, a friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. And there's more than one proverb in here about the idea that when you have a good friend, you'll find that friend to be much better even than potentially your blood relation. There's one here that says, you know, if you've got a good neighbor nearby, that's better than a friend that's far away. And the idea is you can depend on somebody close by that's your good friend. You can choose your friends. You don't choose your family sometimes. But the idea is if you choose the right friend, he's going to be a real asset to you. And this idea of a friend loves at all times. A friend is going to be with you, as the expression goes, through thick and thin. He's going to be there all the time. It doesn't matter what the situation is, he's going to stick by your side. Friends will remain even during hard times, even when physically things aren't going well with you, with sickness or with financial difficulties, something that's bothering you physically here on this earth. A friend's going to stick with you no matter what. Job, if you will look over in Job, but we're going to look in Job a couple of times today, but to begin with, just look in chapter 6 and verse 14. Chapter 6 and verse 14, Job just gives this statement. This isn't particularly into response to what his friends are saying to him. We'll talk about that in just a few minutes. But in Job 6:14, it says, "To him who is afflicted, kindness should be shown by his friend." The idea there is when you're in times of trouble, who are you supposed to rely on? You're supposed to rely on your friend. Your friends are supposed to be there. They're supposed to give you support and encouragement. Even a little bit further than that, friends remain even when other people don't remain, when those friends that you think you have disappear. Friends are there even when nobody else is, when nobody's popular. You think about David. As he's fleeing from Absalom, from Jerusalem, as he goes along his way, is there, as it's just a sad convoy as they leave Jerusalem, trying to get out before Absalom gets in there. In 2 Samuel chapter 15, who does he see coming along his way? He sees his old friend, Hushai. 2 Samuel chapter 15. So even though others are deserting him, he's fleeing from his capital city, his own son has won the hearts of the people. They want him to be king. But in chapter 32, beginning of 2 Samuel 15, it says, "Now it happened as David had come to the top of the mountain where he worshipped God, there was Hushai the Archite coming to meet him with his robe torn and dust on his head." So his friend here comes, recognizing the trouble that David's in, recognizing that nobody else is standing with David right now. And he comes with that sign of mourning. And he does what his friend David asks him to do. David says, "You need to go back to the city and you need to be counsel to my son so you can counteract the counsel of Ahithophel." And we see that Hushai, David's friend, as he's called in verse 37, it says, "So Hushai, David's friend, went into the city and Absalom came into Jerusalem." As we know the rest of the story, Hushai did his work for David quite well. He counteracted the wisdom of Ahithophel. And that led to the defeat of Absalom. So even when friends, other friends who we think are friends, even when they abandon us, even when we're not popular, you think about as Christians, maybe when we stand for something, for the truth, either in an area or a local congregation. And sometimes subjects like modesty and dancing and things like that, they're not real popular these days in some congregations. And you can make yourself not real popular if you insist on being modest and bringing that forth or talk about dancing and lasciviousness, that type of thing. Well, a real friend stays by you and supports you in that. Any other comments or questions about these things we've talked about as far as a friend loving? We have one more point under loving here that we'll get to, but anything else? A friend loves. A friend also puts the best interest of his friends before everything else. There's no better example of that than Jesus. In John chapter 15, and verse 13. Does anybody know what that says right offhand? It says, this is how you know a friend. What does a friend do? A friend lays down his life for his friends. And chapter 15 and verse 13 says, greater love has no one than to lay down his life for his friends. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 16 is also a similar passage along that line. We won't turn there, but what more can you do for someone than to give your life for them? When a friend loves, that's to the degree they love. We're going to talk about Jonathan and David, time permitting, here at the end of the class, or maybe at the end of this section here. But they loved each other as their own soul. It's that type of love, the best interest of the best interest of your friend above your own, even. And Jesus exemplified that in what he did for us. We'll also have some other examples of Jesus and his interactions with his disciples. But just broadly there, under the idea of love, greater love has no man than he will lay down his life for his friend. You've got to put the best interest of your friend in mind.
Love will sound the warning too. Even though what you've got to say to your friend, or the way you act with reference to your friend, may hurt a little bit, start with it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still in the friend's best interest.
That's right. We're going to get specifically to that in just a minute here, but that's exactly right. That's the best interest is doing things sometimes that even your friend may find unpleasant to begin with. Brother Benningfield?
Love sometimes is spoken of as a mortar. As mortar holds bricks together, love holds bricks together.
Yeah. I mean, as mortar holds bricks together, Brother Benningfield says, love holds Christians together. And when we operate under love, sometimes we may find ourselves needing to correct each other or rebuke each other. But when that's done with the right attitude of love, with the knowing that we have each other's best interests in mind, that holds everybody together, makes that bond even tighter. Any other points? The next thing that a good friend does, I find, is a good friend forgives. In Proverbs 17:9, he who covers a transgression seeks love, but he who repeats a matter separates friends. When we say covers a transgression, we don't mean cover it up and don't take responsibility for it. But the one who forgives that, who covers that over, who moves beyond that. And the point we'll make here in just a minute. But he who repeats a matter separates friends. How many times do you hear of somebody making a mistake in the past and all is forgiven, supposedly, and then the next time a big fight comes up, what's the first thing that's brought up? Well, remember when you did that to me back then? All is not forgiven. It comes back to haunt the person who committed the transgression. So, some applications regarding that. Friends forgive the mistakes of friends. You know, if we're really friends and our friends make mistakes, and we all make mistakes sometimes, if we cherish that person, if we love that person, if we like that relationship that we forged with them, we're going to get past that. It may take time, and that's another point that we'll talk about here today, Lord willing. It may take time, but we've got to get past that. We've got to let the benefits of the friendship overcome those transgressions and those mistakes. You think about Paul in 2 Timothy chapter 2 as he writes to Timothy. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 4. And 2 Timothy chapter 4, I'm sorry. 2 Timothy chapter 4, as he writes to Timothy here, beginning in verse 9, he says, be diligent to come to me quickly. And in verse 11, he says, only Luke is with me. Get Mark and bring him with you, for he is useful to my ministry. And then he goes on in verse 16, and he says, at my first defense, no one stood with me, but all forsook me. May it not be charged against them. As he goes through this list of names, and he says, I'm by myself now. He says, get Luke or only Luke is with me. Get Mark and bring him too. Get people to come here. Right now, I'm by myself. And he mentions that first defense. Nobody stood with him as he offered that defense. Granted, that was a time of pretty severe persecution, and it wouldn't have been a very popular thing. Could endanger yourself to stand there. But he says, don't charge my friends with that. These were friends that he was speaking about. And he said, Don't hold that against them, even though they didn't stay with me. Let's just make it right now. Get people here to assist me and help me. Friends forgive, even when their friends make mistakes. You think about Jesus and Peter, even before Peter sins by denying him in Luke chapter 22. In Luke chapter 22, I think we've looked at this verse in one of the other classes that I've talked about. But in Luke chapter 22 and verse 31, he says, "Simon, Simon, Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat, and I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail. And when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren." So before Peter even goes through that process of denying our Lord three times, Jesus says, I know what you're going to do. And after you've done that, and after you've repented of that and made that right, when you've come back to me, he says, I'll be there. He says, strengthen your brother. Note that action was required on Peter's part, though. It wasn't just, Peter, I know you're going to deny me, and I'm going to forgive you of that. He said, Peter, I know you're going to deny me. When you've realized that mistake and you come back to me, then we'll move on from there. So there is some action required for proper forgiveness to take place between friends. Any comments? Or?
Forgiveness can't really take place until that person who has committed the transgression or whatever repents.
That's right.
It stays there. It's there. I mean, you can say, never mind, or forget about it. It's still on him.
That's right. That's a good point to make. Brother Lambert said, for those of you that didn't hear, in order for forgiveness to take place, that person first has to repent of that. Otherwise, it's just hanging out there. You may overlook it and move on, but in order for true forgiveness to take place, that person has to want that forgiveness. So certainly Peter had a part to play there. And we've already talked about the idea of the end of this proverb, he who repeats a matter separates friends. You didn't hear Jesus coming to Peter later as he was an apostle and going about the work. You didn't have Peter having visions of Jesus saying, remember that time when you denied me and how much hurt that caused me? That didn't come up again. Peter made the mistake. Peter repented of the mistake and moved on and was a better person because of it.
Mm-hmm.
No, I didn't. But we might make it later. Go ahead.
There had been a disagreement between Paul and Barnabas over Mark because Mark had left him. And the fact that now that he's later on mentioned the fact of Mark,
he's useful to me, yeah.
There's a sense that implies that whatever disagreement there was or whatever contention Paul had with Mark, and now he's forgiven.
That's right. Yeah. There had been an issue there before. We're talking about John Mark, who went with Paul on the first journey and then left shortly after the journey began. Now we find in Timothy that Paul is saying, send Mark to me. He's going to be useful for me. So we'll see that where Paul had not wanted him on the second journey because he left, time and experience with Mark and knowledge about Mark had healed that wound to where he found Mark to be useful to him. Good point, Scott. Any other thoughts or comments?
And just a general note of application is we go through these a lot of times. We think about Christian to Christian or friend to friend, but what friendship should be closer than that of man and wife, or maybe a mature child and a parent. There's a lot of room for application within our own families as well as outside of our families.
Very much so, especially with the husband-wife bond, and we'll even talk about that at least one other time as we get through the lesson here. So, yeah, definitely. Family, particularly the man and the wife, there shouldn't be closer friends here on this earth.
On this point of repeating a matter, you do something like that, you may get back with your friend. But the problem, a lot of times, is what about those people to whom it has been repeated? They may not know about that. They may not know
that's
that
right.
Things have been squared away.
Yeah.
That thing may last a lifetime.
As you speak, it just spreads and it's tough. It's once it's out there, it's tough to get that back. So be careful. Be careful what we say, especially in regards to what we say to our friends. Any other comments?
Noteworthy here in Luke, where Peter was told
on, get on with your life. But it's not just going about your normal thing. Then he says, strengthen your brethren.
Yeah.
You know, you've got a job to do, and it's not just, you know, mundane life after this. So get on with the Lord for it.
Yeah, once he, that was, I would consider that part of his repentance, I guess. Once he made that thing right, once he returned, part of that returning was going about the business that the Lord had commanded him to do. Excellent points. The final point under the characteristics of a good friend. Friends edify and promote growth. If we look at these real quickly, one that we're probably familiar with in 27:17 is iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friend. The next one there, the idea is the sweetness that is found by hearty counsel that is given, the goodness that is found in a friend giving wise speech, good advice, loyalty there in verse 10 about not forsaking your friend or your father's friend. And like we said, you know, the neighbor nearby, a good friend nearby is going to be of more benefit to you in a time of need than a family member that may be far away. And we've seen this one before as well. Open rebuke is better than love carefully concealed. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful. Brother Lambert made that point that sometimes as friends, because we love, we speak in their best interest. And it may be something that at the time we find as a wound, but it's for our benefit. So what applications can we make from this? How do our friends influence us? As iron sharpens iron, they work together, they rub together, and they make each other a sharper, more effective tool. And that can work both ways. That can be a sharper, more effective tool for good, or that can be a sharper, more effective tool for bad, for wickedness. And a familiar passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 15:32, evil company corrupts good morals, I think it says. That's why I should have turned there. Evil company corrupts good habits, the New King James Version says there. So what kind of friends are we choosing? And the importance there, a good thing we can teach our children and practice ourselves is, are we choosing Christian friends? Friends who are also Christians. Friends who are also children of God. Because as we find out, this idea of iron sharpening iron, that we become, just like a pet and its owner, sometimes they say start to look alike or whatever, friends who work together and are close together and spend a lot of time together, they develop the same characteristics and the same traits. So if we have good friends, if we have godly friends, then we find that those people make us more godly. A husband and wife would definitely fit in here, Trevor. The idea is if we have a godly wife who's about the business of studying her Bible and knowing what the Bible says, well, that helps us as men to be more godly, to study our Bibles more, to work together. Any comments or questions on this idea of iron sharpening iron, the influence that we wield on our friends, or as two friends interact together? Because close friends become more and more alike. We need to depend on our friends in time of need, and by promoting growth and edification. You think about Job. Now, these are some of the other ones that Job says specifically. I would like to look at these. Some of them are almost comical in their reading. Job chapter 16, Job finally speaks out about the comfort that his friends have offered him. And beginning in verse 2, he says, I have heard many, this is Job 16, I have heard many such things, miserable comforters are you all. Shall words of wind have no end? Or what provokes you that you answer? And he goes on through there, we don't have the time to read them, but instead of his friends providing comfort, as Job has lost his health, Job has lost his children, Job has lost everything on this earth, his friends come to him, and what do they say? They say, you sinned. Repent of that sin and move on. They don't look at the evidence that they see of him. They just look at the result and provide no comfort at all to him. Yeah, they had no evidence to show what sin he had committed, but they just made a blanket statement that, well, because you're in the shape, you must have sinned. And in verse 3, or chapter 21, verses 2 and 3, he says, listen carefully to my speech, and let this be your consolation. Bear with me, that I may speak, and after I've spoken, keep mocking. That's what he thought of his friend's comfort. He thought his friends were mocking him, making fun of him even. He says, so after I get done speaking, then you can go on with your mocking and with your tearing down. So friends are supposed to be there in time of need. They're supposed to be loyal to us. And we talked about that a little bit earlier. But we need to recognize that. When we do correct a friend, we need to do it with the proper attitude. There's two passages in the New Testament, Galatians chapter 6 and verse 1. Galatians 6 and verse 1, where it says when you see somebody overtaken in a trespass and you're restoring them, you do it in gentleness and meekness, because you may very well find yourself in the same boat. And in James chapter 5 and verse 19, we won't turn over there, 19 and 20. You need to realize that when you go about correcting someone, you're not doing to tear it down. You're doing it to save their souls. So that open rebuke, when we do that open rebuke, it's not to tear down. It's not because we have our interest in mind to make somebody else look bad. A true friend rebukes, even though it may be painful, because they know it's in the best interest for that person's spiritual well-being, for that person's well-being in general. And when you spank him after that, it's going to hurt a lot too. That's right. Yeah. And that's what love is. I mean, that's what love really is. Love is not worrying that child's going to be mad at you because you've restrained him. So that's a good point. Rebukes can be painful. And this idea at the very end of the kisses of an enemy are deceitful. The first thing that jumped to my mind there was, how did Judas meet Jesus that night in the garden? Came up and gave him a kiss. That was the sign that was the one to take. And Jesus responded, friend, what are you doing here? Or, you know, he called him his friend. The next point, we'll look at some characteristics of bad friends now. If we have time, we're going to go at the end. We'll look at Jonathan and David really quick. If we don't have time for that, I'm going to give you the passages. I'd like you to read them, because that's a really tender friendship. And the idea of commitment and the other's best interest is really in mind there. So I would encourage you to read that in light of what we're talking about. Characteristics that we can have or that we can choose in our friends. The first one for poor friends are our distasteful speech. It says a man of understanding holds his peace. The idea is that a man of foolishness does not hold his speech. If he's devoid of wisdom, he despises his neighbor. He speaks evil of him. Same thing about a scoffer. He's speaking evil of people, and that brings joy. That brings sorrow and despair to his father or his parents. And this idea of I'm going to speak evil. I'm going to do what he deserves. I'm going to get what he deserves. We've talked about it, I think, for a couple classes now, this idea of profitable speech. Are the things we say, are they profitable to say, or are they things that tear down? And especially as we think about being Christians, and like in Romans chapter 12 and verse 8, some of the things that we're instructed to do there as a person that has been transformed from this world do not fit in with speech that tears down. And so if you're hanging out with people who use speech that tears other people down, pretty soon you're going to find yourself using that same type of speech. And as a child of God, we can't be doing that. Romans 12, verse 8, he who exhorts in exhortation, then again in verse 14, bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who weep and weep with those who rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. Verse 17, repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for all men in the sight of all. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. That's not characteristic of poor speech. And we need to realize that. And we find that distasteful speech and the speech that tears down is often rooted in... There's other, often deeper flaws that go beyond that. You think of the story about Ahab. Well, how did he get that vineyard from Nabal? His wife Jezebel hired two men. They had a feast. They sat Nabal at the high place of the feast, and then the two men right beside him started slandering him, saying he'd blaspheme God, he'd blaspheme the king, and had him stoned. Just with evil speech, tore him down till he was actually killed. And a couple of chapters later, we see Jehoshaphat has chosen Ahab as his friend. They decide to go to war together. Jehoshaphat says, "Ahab, you know, my men and people are as your people. We're knit together in this." And then he says, "Let's consult God." And then Ahab goes about throughout the next chapter just tearing down Micaiah for what he says. He says, there is one prophet left that we can inquire, but he always speaks evil of me. And as that goes on, and Micaiah tells him what he wants to hear, he says, "How many times have I told you that you got to speak the truth of God?" Which he didn't mean that at all. So Micaiah speaks the truth, and he says, "See, didn't I tell you? He always speaks evil of me." Ahab, a wicked man, and his speech reflected that. Any comments or questions about our speech and how we need to be speaking? How friends that are not good friends will have speech that tears down and not builds up. That's right. That's right. Yeah. But that just makes me think about even Jehoshaphat had chosen Ahab as his friend. That wasn't a wise choice, and he should have been able to see through the instructions and the conversations there with Ahab that he was going to be led to trouble by that, and he was. Next one is anger. "Make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man do not go, lest you learn his ways and set a snare for your soul." When we see someone that has anger in them, especially when we group together with friends like we do, and one of them is angry, and we are more likely to adapt that same mentality, we find ourselves in numbers doing things that we wouldn't normally do, almost a gang mentality. So we need to beware of associating with someone who is known to have a bad temper and act on that temper. Because as the proverb writer tells us, trouble follows an angry man. There's a couple of proverbs there that says the angry man, his way leads to strife. His way leads to trouble. And so beware of that angry man. Have you thought about, or just imagine for a minute, if you were Samson's friend in the Judges. You were back in the days of the Judges and you were Samson's friend. I mean, yeah, it'd be kind of cool to be hanging out with the strongest guy around. But Samson, he said, you know, he would get mad and he would do something. And then he'd say, "I'm going to stop." But of course, then the Philistines would be mad and they would retaliate at him. And he'd say, "Well, I can't be held accountable this time. Look what they've done to me. I have no blame this time." And he would do something worse. And just back and forth, until it led to the destruction of both Samson and the Philistines. Just imagine if you were hanging out with a guy like Samson and the things that you would be associated with. You would be there, as it spoke of him, hip and thigh in the Philistines, given the slaughter and the dangers associated with that. It just never ends. It just escalates and escalates and escalates. The danger of being associated with an angry man. I know we've covered that one quickly. We're going to have to move a little bit faster here, but any comments or questions about anger and the dangers of that in selecting our friends? And make sure that we're not angry people. You know, make sure we're not being that type of influence on our friends as well. Those who desire evil or wickedness, if you look at these proverbs here, the soul of the wicked desires evil, his neighbor finds no favor in his eyes. And we'll find that a lot of the evil was always directed against, you know, his fellow man. Whoever rewards evil for good there at the bottom will not depart from his house. Evil will not depart from his house. No one benefits from the wickedness or the violence of friends. We've talked about Proverbs chapter 1 several times. When the young man is warned against those people that would come and say, you know, "Come join yourselves to us and we'll have one common pot of money, and we'll go about and we'll steal from people, we'll cause violence to people, we'll take their belongings, and then we'll live off of those spoils. What's the end result of that type of lifestyle as you get further on towards verse 19 of chapter 1 there? What happens to that man that agrees to have those friends, and what happens to those friends? They're caught, you know, they're caught like birds in a net. Their own trouble comes back upon them, and their own blood is shed, and they come to a violent end, and that's the way. In 2 Samuel chapter 13 and verse 3 is the story of Amnon and Tamar. Where did Amnon get the idea of how to lure Tamar to him so he could rape her? Got it from his friend Jonadab. His friend Jonadab said, "You know, why should you sit here and pine like this? You know, you pretend you're sick, and we'll get Tamar to come and feed you, and then you'll have the opportunity to do with her as you will." But you think about Joab. Joab, in particular cases I've thought about, is Joab with Abner after Saul was dead, and Abner came to bring the kingdom together. Joab called him back and pulled him aside as a friend. "How are you?" And killed him. Or when during the rebellion of Sheba, David had made Amasa the captain of his army to go out and pursue Sheba. Joab came, he found Amasa alongside the road, greeted him as a friend, pulled him close, grabbed him by the beard, and killed him. The sorrow that Joab caused David, and David even wrote about it, particularly spoke about it when he was giving instruction to Solomon before Solomon took over, about all the trouble that Joab and his family has caused me. So we need to beware of the wicked person. They're just going to lead us to trouble. What did it cost Jonadab? What did it cost Amnon? What did the advice of his friend Jonadab cost him? Cost him his life, because Absalom killed him in that same chapter there. Absalom killed him. He waited a couple of years, but Absalom killed him because of what he had done to his sister Tamar. So severe consequences for being with wicked people. Just a short one on thieves. Whoever partners with a thief hates his own life. He swears to tell the truth but reveals nothing. If you're going to be a friend with a thief or a dishonest person, lies and deception on your part will be necessary to maintain that friendship. I mean, if he's going to live that life and you're going to be associated with him, you're going to have to participate in those same things to cover his deeds. And without much doubt, you can see that you'll probably share in those spoils of his dishonesty. The benefits that he receives, if you're going to be associated with him, spending time with him, you're going to be partaking in those things that he's received from his dishonest means. Now, the idea of gluttony or excess, whoever keeps the law is a discerning son, but a companion of gluttons shames his father. You think about Eli's sons and how they lived to excess, to the point where it says that men abhorred the worship of the Lord because they had to go through the sons of Eli. And they abhorred that. You think of David's sons that we already talked about. Amnon, Absalom, Adonijah. These men that were not restrained. And the grief that they caused him. You think of modern examples. You hear stories in college sports of you know, the team that doesn't have to take real classes or anything like that. And they get A's. And this idea of being untouchable, kind of a brat pack type thing. They can do whatever they want because they have friends in high places. Recently, there was a story about a group of girls in Texas, I think, that were just terrorizing the school, getting teachers fired, doing whatever. The lead girl of that group was the principal of the high school. And she refused to restrain her child. When you live to excess, it brings shame to your parents. And when you run around in a group like that, it's shameful to see, and certainly something that we need to be aware of. The idea of favoritism, and we'll combine this with flattery as well. The rich man can find friends pretty easily, can't he? If you're willing to give gifts, you'll be sure to have friends. It says the poor man there in verse 19, verse 7, all the brothers of the poor hate him. How much more do his friends go far from him? The rich man, he's got all the friends that he wants, but the poor man, even his family, doesn't want to be associated with him, yet alone his friends, and he may call to them and ask them for help, and they won't have anything to do with him. We need to be aware of the power of money and that has on people and their influence. You think about Judas. Go ahead, brother. What's that?
The prodigal.
Yeah, that's a good example. The prodigal son, he went and he took his money and he wasted it in riotous living and also on harlots. And then a famine came and he spent it all. And then a famine came. He had nothing. And it said, who helped him? No one. All those friends that were there to spend the riotous living, all those harlots that were there to spend his wealth, they're gone now. Fair weather friends, as we call them. Yeah. When the money's gone, the friends were gone. And also the idea of Judas. You have to think at one time Judas and Jesus were friends. Jesus called him a friend. But yet he was willing for money to betray him. And also flattery, similar to that. A man who flatters his feet spreads a net. Flatters his neighbor, spreads a net for his feet. The flatterer wants something. The person that will say anything to be your friend and flatter you, he wants something. And he either wants something that you possess, whether it be material or position or status, or he wants to deceive you for another purpose. But the flatterer wants something. Any questions or other bad characteristics that we can think of? I apologize for going through that so fast. But. Okay, well, we've got just a couple minutes left. And let's look at some of these things that we can do to create and maintain and repair friendships that we have. First thing is pretty obvious. A man who has friends must himself be friendly. Don't expect to have friends if you're just going to mope around or if you're going to stand off in the corner and expect everyone to come to you. That's not the way to build a friendship. Abraham in Genesis chapter 18 was friendly to those men that came to him. And he invited them in. He had a meal. And they turned out to be angels and the Lord himself. And we find in the next chapter that through that hospitality, through him being friendly, he had the opportunity to influence the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. It was still destroyed. They couldn't find the 10 righteous souls. But through him, he was able to say to the Lord, will you do it for 50? Will you do it for 45? So friendliness. We don't know what power we have to change just by being friendly. And we've already looked at Romans chapter 12. We won't go back there again. But if we're going to be transformed and not conformed to this world, we have to be hospitable. We have to act with brotherly kindness. We have to have other people's interests at heart. So there's things we need to do, and being friendly is one of them. This idea, opposite of a bad characteristic, we need to have pleasant speech. Sweetness to the soul and health to the bones are the pleasant words, that we can speak, and that can make us desirable friends. This idea of profitable speech that we've talked about several times, and an application I thought about in the book of Acts with both the Philippian jailer and with Apollos, how does the word of God spread? Often it spreads through the spoken word. And instead of speaking speech that tears down, we speak pleasant words. Aquila and Priscilla pulled Apollos aside, explained to him more accurately the word of God and the benefit that was there. Those prisoners, and presumably the Philippian jailer as well, heard Paul and Silas, heard them praying, heard them singing as they went about till midnight. Pleasant speech makes a good friend, or goes a long way towards creating a good friend. This idea of taking time to make friendships and repair friendships. A wise man scales the city of the mighty and brings down the trusted stronghold. A brother offended is harder to win than a strong city, and the contentions are like the bars of a castle. Once you build that trust up, and this is where, what we mentioned earlier about, a husband and wife, and you build that trust up for years and years and years, and then adultery, just one instance of adultery comes into the picture. That trust is gone, and a wall has been erected that will take a long, long time to tear that back down and restore that trust again. And the same is true with friends. It just takes a lot of trust and hard work. And as Scott mentioned, he's going to pick up his kid. As Scott mentioned, John Mark was there and he left, And Paul held him accountable for that on the next journey. But we find that years later, he had earned that trust back. It just takes trust and time to build and repair relationships. Ill will towards others. When we hope for the worst and we express that publicly, even on things like this, when we see somebody fall, tear down the trust, we need to make sure that we don't speak ill of them and let other people see that because of the influence that we have. Don't take pleasure in the failures of others. We have one more point, and we might cover that when we start back the next time. So, if you will, hold on to. We'll cover one more point, and then we'll get into the perils of riches. Thank you for your attention.